From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with writer Toni Morrison. Her new novel, Jazz, is set in Harlem in the 20s. It's about people who migrated from the rural South to the urban North, like Morrison's parents did. Also, the most creative producers who have shaped American television. We talk with David Mark about his new book on the subject. Rock historian Ed Ward plays one of 1963's most unlikely hits. And film critic Stephen Schiff remembers Indian film director Satyajit Ray, who died yesterday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush said today that his administration is taking measures to streamline banking regulations and to encourage lending in the real estate markets. The president also asserted that his 90-day moratorium on new federal regulations has saved U.S. consumers and taxpayers tens of billions of dollars. He hinted that the regulation freeze may be extended when it expires next week. Deputy Treasury Secretary John Robson said that federal regulators from different agencies have agreed to coordinate their efforts so that financial institutions can avoid duplications in supervision. Critics said that many of the proposals announced today are merely reworkings of plans that have been on the boards for a long time. Tens of thousands of members of the Polish trade union Solidarity marched through Warsaw today, calling on the country's politicians to provide more effective government. The demonstration comes amid growing discontent with high unemployment and a weak minority government. Julian Borger reports from Warsaw.
Warsaw hasn't seen a demonstration like this since Solidarity took on the communist regime in the 80s. Along the route, the demonstrators shouted experts to power, politicians to the dustbin, echoing President Wałęsa's recent call for a non-partisan government of experts to take the place of the present fragile coalition government of Prime Minister Jan Olszewski. At the presidential palace, the marchers handed Mr. Wałęsa a list of demands, calling on him to exert more influence on Polish politics and on the economy. Mr. Wałęsa said he supported the demands and added he would visit factories next week to talk to the workers. The march is seen here as a test of strength, not only of Solidarity, but also of Mr. Wałęsa, its former leader. Union sources said he'd helped organize the demonstration. For National Public Radio, I'm Julian Borger in Warsaw.
General Motors announced seven key executive appointments today aimed at stemming the flow of red ink in the automaker's struggling North American operations. Don Gagne reports.
The appointments are part of GM's ongoing reorganization program, which began late last year. They follow, by less than 3 weeks, a shakeup among the automaker's top executive ranks, which analysts say was a result of a lack of progress in cutting costs and streamlining the company. Today's announcement puts Michael Losh, former head of GM's Oldsmobile division, in charge of all North American sales and marketing. GM has also created the position of vice president in charge of worldwide purchasing, which should result in lower component costs. Auto analyst Dave Cole of the University of Michigan.
Really, some fundamental changes in the way the organization thinks and operates are in store, and I think the organization is crying out for those kind of things, and they're going to get it. I'm very confident of that.
GM had been expected to announce the elimination of certain car models, but no such plans were revealed today. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
The Dow Industrials lost more than 24 points today. This is NPR News. Officials in Guadalajara, Mexico, said today that the explosion that killed at least 176 people on Tuesday was apparently caused by leaking gasoline. Residents of Guadalajara's Reforma district had complained of smelling gas odors coming from the sewer system shortly before at least nine explosions leveled much of their neighborhood. The state-run oil company, Pemex, found a leak in one of its lines yesterday and continued checking for leaks today. Democratic presidential candidate Bill Clinton spoke at a $1,000 a plate fundraiser during a campaign stop in Columbus, Ohio today. The Arkansas governor says Washington is draining state's budgets. Rick Tilton of member station WOSU in Columbus reports.
Clinton says Washington should take most of the blame for budget crunches in the states. Clinton takes aim at President Bush and both parties in Congress.
The state budget problems of the nation are the direct result of national economic policy leading to economic decline and national political policy, bipartisan, President and Congress, sending us more mandates every year and less money to cover it.
In a teleconference with the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, Clinton says Hispanics will play prominent roles if he's elected.
We should have a broad base, a large number of Hispanics in the cabinet, in the sub-cabinet positions, leading the state, the federal agencies.
Clinton says he wants aggressive health education programs and clinics in poor neighborhoods. For National Public Radio, I'm Rick Tilton in Columbus.
Civil rights leaders in Los Angeles said today that they'll urge calm if four white police officers are acquitted of brutality charges in the beating of a black man. The possibility of racial unrest arose after Police Chief Daryl Gates warned police officers that some leaders in the community might try to stir up trouble if the officers are not found guilty. Civil rights leaders said that Gates was deliberately setting himself against the leaders of the African American community by suggesting that they might foment violence. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Recently on Fresh Air, book critic John Leonard reviewed Jazz, the new novel by my guest Toni Morrison. He described the book as a magic act and called Morrison the best writer in America. Jazz is Morrison's sixth novel, her first new one since Beloved, which won a Pulitzer Prize in 1988. Jazz is set in Harlem in 1926 and is about African Americans who moved from the rural South to the urban North. It's also about love, jealousy, violence, and aging. A woman named Violet finds out her husband has been having an affair with a younger woman who he has killed. At the funeral, Violet takes revenge on the corpse. Here's Toni Morrison reading the opening.
I know that woman. She used to live with a flock of birds on Lenox Avenue. Know her husband, too. He fell for an 18-year-old girl with one of those deep-down, spooky loves that made him so sad and happy he shot her just to keep the feeling going. When the woman, her name is Violet, went to the funeral to see the girl and to cut her dead face, they threw her to the floor and out of the church. She ran then through all that snow. And when she got back to her apartment, she took the birds from their cages and set them out the windows to freeze or fly, including the parrot that said, "I love you." The snow she ran through was so windswept, she left no footprints in it. So for a time, nobody knew exactly where on Lenox Avenue she lived. But like me, they knew who she was, who she had to be, because they knew that her husband, Joe Trace, was the one who shot the girl. There was never anyone to prosecute him because nobody actually saw him do it. And the dead girl's aunt didn't want to throw money to helpless lawyers or laughing cops when she knew the expense wouldn't improve anything. Besides, she found out that the man who killed her niece cried all day. And for him and for Violet, that is as bad as jail.
That's Toni Morrison reading from her new novel, Jazz. You know, the woman who cuts the face of the dead woman, a character later says to the woman who does the cutting, "I don't understand women like you, women with knives." Do you understand women with knives, kind of crimes of passion like that?
Not entirely. I think part of the reason I was interested in the story and in that period was some way to figure out the impulses for violence as a sort of notion of solution and how it plays into notions of license and freedom. So it was a quest, really, on my part. I'm not quite sure I understand that kind of excess.
Was there a particular crime that you wanted to understand, or a particular woman with a knife who you wanted to understand?
The woman I really wanted to understand was Dorcas, the young girl who is based on a historical figure, actually, a young girl who died in Harlem at a rent party, shot by her lover with a silencer, and who refused to let anybody help her because she wanted to give him time to get away, and waited so long that she bled to death. That was extremely provocative to me, that notion of that kind of romance that probably is representative of someone that young, her acceptance of his violence, the way in which a young girl or a woman deals with assault under certain circumstances in certain eras and periods.
What's the closest you've seen to this in real life?
I've never seen any of it. I mean, I don't... If I had seen it or participated in it, I probably wouldn't be so interested in writing about it. But it's what I... It was sort of outside one's own personal experience that is compulsive.
No family legends or neighborhood legends from when you were growing up?
Not about women. About men, yes, who were championed because of their endurance and their response to violence associated with them. But the women that I knew were, I suppose, in a manner verbally able to deflect violence. There's a passage in jazz about the kind of women who needed a certain kind of protection. There were those who had razors taped to their hands. There were those who were willing to boil a lie and those who were willing to put ground glass in food. But there is a secondary passage which explains what a large majority of black women did in terms of trying to protect themselves. The church, the club movement, the acquisition of property. I think the line goes, any black woman in 1926 who did not share some of those protective gestures was silent or crazy or dead.
Toni Morrison is my guest. You have this sense in your novel, Jazz, of people coming to Harlem or coming to the city and feeling more like themselves there, more like the people they always believed they were, is the way you put it. That's obviously something you were really interested in developing in the story, just what it meant physically and emotionally for people to move to the city. You must have stories about that in your family history.
Oh, I do, yes. That move from the rural areas where I think in literature sometimes we romanticize into the freedom of the countryside, you know, the sort of ability to commune with nature and be one's transcendent self. And there is that mythos in literature. And there's an accompanying one, which is the freedom of a city. On the one hand, there's a certain kind of anonymity, but more particularly for, and especially for African Americans, it was moving into an area where there were so many of you. You could see yourself in your number, and there was a certain kind of protection in that, as well as some license. Also, it was, I don't know, the idea of a city as being a place where there is a mix, where there are many classes, many kinds of people. And however eccentric you are, there are, you know, at least 100 other people who are eccentric in precisely the same way. So that one has solitude, solitariness, individuality, and community in a city. I'm not sure we can think up a city like that anymore. But that's what the ideal is. And that's why, you know, when we think of New York in the 20s or other large urban areas in our either invented mechanisms or actually historically there, what was the innocence and the sin, the excitement and the comfort of being in a huge metropolitan area? And I think that, you know, impelled and compelled African-Americans as it did immigrants. There was a risk there, but there was enormous opportunity, and there was some safety.
Would you share with us one of your parents' migration stories?
Yes. I think one of the ones that I remember best was when my mother's parents left the South, left Alabama. My grandmother's husband, my grandfather, had gone to a large city to earn some money playing the violin, as a matter of fact, and she was alone on their farm with these children who were very, very young. I think my mother was 5. And there was some danger about. It was the time when a woman alone with several children was a kind of a target. And her words were that when she noticed white boys beginning to circle that house, she had to leave immediately. So she sent word to her husband, to my grandfather, by somebody who was en route to tell him that she would be on X train at X time. and that if he wanted to see them again, he should be there. And so they left in the middle of the night. In the middle of the night, because there's always debt in that sort of sharecropping situation that most post-Reconstruction black people found themselves in, and went to Birmingham and got on the train. And as the train pulled out, there was no papa. And the children all began to wail and cry. And a few miles outside the city, he appeared, but he hadn't felt that he could show himself at the station and get on with them, because they were escaping that cycle of debt, you know, that round that you can never really escape, because, you know, the commissary of the general store you need for the feed, and that takes the crops, etc. So it was a happy event for them. And then the subsequent stops on that route to where they were headed, looking for work for mines that were asking for laborers, for mills, for women who could work in service, is an interesting and very typical story. And they ended up on the shores of Lake Erie, where I was born.
In Ohio?
Yes.
What was Lorraine like when you were growing up? What kind of neighborhood were you growing up in?
It was an interesting place. I still think it's remarkable. In that part of Ohio, and I think in many of those states, I never lived in a black neighborhood. Because what we were living in were really just poor neighborhoods. So that I grew up with all of the other immigrants who were coming to this country. I'm thinking, as I speak to you now, of the house where my mother lives at this moment. And the people on the street are named Tershak and Galini and my mother and a black woman named Mrs. Ross and so on. That's always been the case in that town because it was a steel town. And people were coming from Mexico, from Eastern Europe, from Scandinavia, from everywhere, as well as black people coming to these centers just after World War I and in some instances before, in order to find work. So we had a kind of town that was, all the ideals that are probably purely rhetorical, existed in that little town. However, everybody, whether they were Polish people or what they used to call Slovenes in those days, had their own halls, churches, and, family life. That was not mixed. You know, you didn't exchange on those areas in those days. But there's one high school, four junior high schools, and we all went to the same school.
So what was the African-American cultural center? Was it the church or was it something else? The church?
Absolutely, the church.
And you'd go every Sunday? Beyond Sunday?
Well, they had a very, complicated social life. Mm-hmm. Part of it was Sunday, part of it was Sunday school, but a lot of it was taking care of each other. Mm-hmm. And what I remember most is the impetus and the necessity for my mother and her friends and for all of us to take food to people who needed it or to go clean somebody's house if they were bedridden. All sorts of chores were taken for granted. When people got old, they didn't have any place for them to go. And if their families were indigent or couldn't take care of them, that was the responsibility of the women of the church or of the neighborhood. It was just a constant part of one's life. I think in The Bluest Eye, I recorded something similar that really happened, which is my sister and I would sleep in the same bed, and we might wake up and there might be a child next to us, somebody who was in difficulty or the parent was sick or gone, and women in the neighborhood would take them in. And there might be some children living with us for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks or months or what have you. And we were not, it was a kind of violation of what everybody seems to think is important now, which is intimacy and privacy. And of course, as a young girl, I wanted to leave it. But at the same time, it was a kind of sharing of of responsibilities. Social responsibilities was, no one ever talked about it and said, you ought to be a responsible member of the society. But everything people did was like that.
Well, it would seem to me that in your adult life as a single mother, writer, and editor, that you would have had precious little time to devote to the community. I mean, because you had to be so busy with bringing up your own children and, you know, earning a living and writing and so on.
It's true. I had precious little time. I didn't think of it that way because I understood my work to be very much bound up with service to the community. But what I missed, I'll have to tell you, was the community service to me. You know, I understood that if I lived in Lorain, Ohio, and I was working and I had small children, I wouldn't have to get a babysitter. Somebody would do that and ask me, did I need help? Or, you know, those kinds of things on the block or on the street were people who watched your children because they took that as part of what being an adult was like.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Toni Morrison. She has a new novel called Jazz. She also has a new book of literary criticism called Playing in the Dark, Whiteness and the Literary Imagination. We'll take a short break, then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. Writer Toni Morrison is my guest. In your new book of literary criticism, Playing in the Dark, you write about how until recently American readers were assumed to be white, and you wonder what that assumption has meant to the literary imagination in America. When you started reading, were you conscious of reading books in which there were few, if any, black characters?
No, I was conscious of there being a sort of disruption in some books when black people did occur. And there was a kind of embarrassment, a kind of a need to skip over those parts in, say, being in the 10th grade and reading Uncle Tom's Cabin, or seeing children's books in which, was it Sambo? I mean, you know, these kinds of things. And you sort of politely erase them from your consciousness until you get older. And then when I became a writer, I had to function in a language that was coded in a number of ways. And I had to work with those codes. I didn't have access to some of the metaphors and shortcuts that, say, a white writer has who feels he or she is unraced. And they can take for granted the centrality of their experience because it is white, and they think that's being without a race. Everybody else has race. White people don't. They could take for granted that kind of centrality, and they could use cleverly, brilliantly, effectively or not, as the case might be, the presence of black people, just as they frequently did the presence of women. It's sort of something you have in your kit.
So when you say that the language was coded, let me get you to elaborate on the kind of code you felt you had to cut through or work around.
Well, calling slaves slaves instead of laborers or workers is one code. Using black women and men to appear in a scene for no reason other than to provide the tension that might suggest illegal sexuality or violence. They have no other function except to define and to suggest to be the association of. And you wonder, why are they there? And they may never be picked up again. But they have this impact. To have classical American literature to need to establish virtue, power, and dominance over something, and to need an obedient black person or someone who loves you irrationally. Mark Twain's Jim is irrational in that sense. His love is boundless. And he's a grown man talking to children. I could not do that, say, with a white man who was an ex-convict.
I think it's fair to say that in most of your fiction, there's really been very few significant white characters.
Well, yes.
Yeah, so how does that relate to what you're talking about now, about the, you know, about the code? And
in a sense, having, it would be silly for me to write or to concentrate on major white characters, because I wasn't interested in it, and also it destabilizes the progress of the narrative in a way. For example, putting a young black girl center stage, it seemed to me a radical thing to do in 1965 when I first began writing The Bluest Eye. Once you begin to permit the reins of the narrative to be held by a major white person, you lose the agency and you lose the terrain, the imaginative terrain, because you may be forced into responding to a white presence instead of examining what the interior lives of these people are without the constant need to explain, to editorialize, and to fix. So it was an enormous liberation for me, and one that I find to be repeated a lot, particularly in the work of black women. Once you take those people out, then it's as though the whole world is available now for one's own creativity. But in a sense, it's all a little bit more real than that. White people were not central to my life. They were out there, sort of on the edge, sometimes wonderful and enabling, sometimes hostile and disabling. But the heart of the life, even in the town that I described, was in our household, in our family. So that in the novels, I wanted to, in that sense, not have characters who were always required to do what I don't think we were required to do, is to consistently think about what white people were thinking. It makes you reduce them in some sort of stereotypical way that I would shy away from. But certainly I was interested and fascinated by and sort of thrilled by a number of minor figures, that is, secondary figures, enabling figures in who are white, such as Amy Denver in Beloved, who is not required to be a white person in that scene because she's not around any other white people. So she can go ahead and be a person. And also, she does something I think that almost never happens, if ever, in American fiction, which is to have a white person touch a black person with some motive other than sex or violence.
Toni Morrison, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
And my guest has been writer Toni Morrison. She has a new novel called Jazz, and it's just been published by Knopf. She also has a new book of literary criticism called Playing in the Dark, Whiteness and the Literary Imagination, and that's published by the Harvard University Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Sit, Ubu, Sit. Have you noticed that more and more producers have elaborate personal logos after their shows? We'll talk with David Mark, whose new book proposes that producers have played the most important role in shaping entertainment television. Producers like Stephen Bochco, Norman Lear, Aaron Spelling, and Quinn Martin. Remember the 1963 hit Sally Go Round the Roses? Rock historian Ed Ward tries to decipher why such an unlikely song made it into the top 10. And we talked to film critic Stephen Schiff about Indian film director Satyajit Ray, who died yesterday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. France, Poland, and Germany are calling on the UN to take urgent action to stem the most recent round of fighting in Yugoslavia. But UN officials are expected to oppose any intervention in the conflict, at least for now. NPR's Jim Zarrilli reports.
The foreign ministers of the three countries issued a joint statement today calling on the UN to meet its responsibility to end the fighting in Bosnia-Herzegovina. They urged the Security Council to extend the mandate of the 14,000-member peacekeeping force now being deployed in neighboring Croatia. But UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali opposes any involvement in Bosnia as long as the fighting continues. About 200 people have died in the conflict during the past month. UN peacekeeping forces traditionally go into battle areas only if all of the warring parties agree to stop fighting. While the United States has taken a harder line towards Serbia lately, it is backing the Secretary General's cautious approach. At the UN, this is Jim Zarrilli reporting.
Former Soviet President Gorbachev says if leaders of the newly independent states don't learn to work together, there could be chaos. Just back from a trip to Japan, the former Soviet leader indicated in Moscow concern over disputes between Russia and Ukraine concerning the Soviet nuclear arsenal and the Black Sea Fleet. And he criticized those leaders who, he said, try to prove that they are resolute. The U.S. Labor Department has started an effort to take over the workplace safety program in the state of North Carolina. It's the first time the department has ever tried to take over a state program, and it comes in response to last September's fire at a North Carolina chicken processing plant, which killed 25 people. Adam Hochberg of member station WUNC reports.
Investigations after the fire revealed the plant had dozens of safety violations, but it never had been inspected by the state. The U.S. Labor Department said the North Carolina Worker Safety Program substantially fails to protect the state's workers, and the department began the legal process to take it over. But North Carolina Labor Commissioner John Brooks, who runs the state program, said the federal action is an effort to sabotage his reelection campaign.
This is quite simply an attempt by the current Republican Secretary of Labor, Lynn Martin, to unseat an elected Democratic Labor Commissioner without regard for the impact it has upon the working men and women of North Carolina, as well as the hardworking professional staff employed by our program, by your Department of Labor.
Brooks says his program does a better job protecting North Carolina workers than the federal government could do. For National Public Radio, I'm Adam Hochberg in Raleigh, North Carolina.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 24 points to close at 3,324.46 on volume of 199 million shares. This is NPR News. A day after U.S. criticism of its economic policy, Germany answered with the top government official saying that his nation was not responsible for all of Europe. Yesterday, a U.S. Treasury Department official charged that German economic policies are hurting all of Europe. These exchanges come before a weekend meeting of the Group of Seven, timed for a spring meeting of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. The State Secretary of the German Finance Ministry said it was not acceptable that the Group of Seven be burdened by one-sided public comments by a senior official. In the wake of this week's series of explosions in Guadalajara, Mexico, an oil refinery has been roped off, reportedly due to a major gas leak and the possibility of more explosions. Sandina Robbins reports.
four neighborhoods surrounding the government-owned Pemex plant in Guadalajara have been evacuated. A broken pipeline was finally located after reportedly spilling 600,000 liters of gasoline. Pemex officials continue to deny that Wednesday's explosions were caused by the huge gas leak. They claim that the gasoline pipeline broke from the explosions. But following the resignations of Guadalajara's mayor and three top city officials, the new head of the sewer system, Jose Luis Macias, said that it appears it was gasoline that caused the explosions. Pemex was the first to accuse a cooking oil factory of leaking the liquid gas hexane into Guadalajara's sewage system, but experts now say it is unlikely that hexane caused Wednesday's explosions. For National Public Radio, I'm Sandina Robbins reporting.
Russian citizens are leaving Libya now that UN sanctions against Libya have been imposed. A spokesman for the Russian Foreign Ministry says getting 3,000 people out of the country and cutting economic ties will not be easy. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has ordered a suspension of arms sales to Libya. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. From time to time, our rock historian Ed Ward takes a look at one-hit wonders, groups that hit the charts with a mighty blaze and then vanished. Often the songs that brought the glory were novelties, but in the case of the Jeanettes and Sally Go Round the Roses, Ed says the song was great.
Very few records as mysterious as this one. It's a chant repeating itself over and over for 3 minutes and 15 seconds. The words change very slightly, but the story remains veiled in mystery. The record was cut in 1963 by the Jeanettes, four Bronx girls who had been recording without success since 1956 for a variety of tiny record labels. Before this record, for instance, they'd cut something called We Belong to Each Other on the Goldie label. Somehow, Abner Spector, no relation to Phil Spector, decided to sign them to a new label he'd started called Tough. Its trademark was a boxing glove. The Jeanettes' names were Mary Sue Wells, Ethel Davis, Ada Ray, and Yvonne Bushnell. Somewhere I seem to remember reading that Mary Sue Wells' mother was their manager, and that she let them practice at her place and kept after them to stay in school. Certainly the fact that they'd been professionals, even at a low level, for 7 years before they hooked up with Spector indicates a great deal of commitment, a great deal of faith. But where was Spector's faith in the Jeanettes? When the record came out, the B-side was Sally Go Round the Roses Sing Along Without the Jeanettes. The next two records he put out by them, Keep an Eye on Her and Snowman, Snowman, Sweet Potato Nose, had the same sort of B-sides. Maybe there was just so much tape. Maybe he was trying to make sure nobody played the wrong side. If you're interested, those two songs, along with No Love at All, their last for Tough, are on the Jeanettes album, Sally Go Round the Roses, which ought to set you back about $50.
Sally Go Round the
Roses.
Sally Go Round the Roses.
They won't tell your secret.
No, the roses.
Sally Go Round the Roses is a jump rope game. I don't know how it's played, but the chorus of the song could be heard on playgrounds 30 years ago. The Jeanettes made up the rest. What was Sally's secret, the one the roses wouldn't tell? Sally Go Round the Roses was one of the best-selling records of 1963, getting as high as number two. It was one of the very last vocal group records to be a smash hit before the Beatles came along and changed the rules of the game. It's an amazing performance. The Jeanettes sing louder and softer. The instrumental backing, that's allegedly Buddy Miles on drums, by the way, is subtle, with a reed organ playing a tiny cue to start each verse. What was Sally's secret? What's the mystery of this song? What was it that caught people's ears and made them buy it? A lesbian from Harlem I once met told me that it was the traditional last dance in the bars she frequented. Grace Slick later recorded it with her band, The Great Society. I don't need to tell you this. They didn't come close.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle, and he's the co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. David Mark is one of a new breed of TV scholars who treats the medium with the same respect and critical scrutiny given to other art forms. His new book, Prime Time, Prime Movers, is a guide to the TV producers who have shaped the medium. Mark thinks that although until recently producers have been fairly invisible to the public, they are the true auteurs of the medium, the ones who are most responsible for creating the programs. The producers he includes range from James L. Brooks, whose series include The Mary Tyler Moore Show, Taxi, Tracy Ullman, and The Simpsons, to Sherwood Schwartz, creator of Gilligan's Island and The Brady Bunch, not to mention A Very Brady Christmas. Producers' names are becoming more familiar to TV audiences. Stephen Bochco is one of the best examples.
I think you're beginning to see whole audiences following different creators, especially upscale audiences. I think it's no coincidence that Stephen Bochco's programs are not promoed when he has a new program, not so much promoed by their stars, but promoed by the producer. At first, it was a sort of simple thing, like from the people who gave you Hill Street Blues. But with Civil Wars, his recent program, his name was used in promoting the series.
Let's look at sitcoms and look at some of the producers there who you've singled out. Let's start with Paul Henning. He's somebody you've been writing about since your first book. He's the creator of the Beverly Hillbillies, Petticoat Junction, Green Acres. What does that add up to?
Well, there's a definite kind of aesthetic associated with Henning. His own life, he was a kid from the Ozarks who came to California, specifically Beverly Hills, working in Hollywood, and became a millionaire. Is it just a coincidence that that's the story of Jed Clampett, and that his whole career is obsessed with this idea of contrasting the life of the bi-coastal and well-to-do versus middle American just plain folks?
You know, Green Acres drives me crazy because it's on every weekday night on Nickelodeon, on Nick at Night.
You're so conservative, Terry.
Well, I just really detest the series. I don't think I've ever watched a full episode. I just get, like, a minute in, I think, like, oh, I can't watch any more of this. And I've never kind of gotten beyond that. I know some people are really passionate and obsessed by it or something. Certainly, a lot of people must be watching it. Maybe you can explain to me what the appeal is.
You know, some people like Emile Zola, others like Louis Bunuel. What Green Acres does that's so interesting to some people is that it explodes all the conventions of naturalistic narrative. and there's a kind of pleasure in this. I think one of the reasons that Green Acres is the way it is because now we're going into the final years of what was Henning's 12-year dominance in sitcoms, and they were simply running out of plots. And so not bound by the kinds of rules that tend to bind, you know, people committed to naturalistic narrative or social realism or whatever, they just went crazy. He just went crazy. Arnold the Pig is, you know, writing a book about television. The hens lay square eggs. And there is the Eddie Albert character, who is a lawyer, a graduate of an Ivy League school, and represents naturalistic post-Cartesian mind. And he's living in a world where nothing he knows is worth anything. So there's a kind of fun in that. I mean, if you're watching Green Acres because you're interested in the development of characterization, a realistic look at contrasts between rural and urban life and so forth, it will fail on that level every time. But if you watch a lot of Brady Bunch, Leave It to Beaver, Donna Riccio, and so forth, it's nothing but a refreshing change.
Let's look at Norman Lear, who is a name that a lot of people will recognize. He's one of the producers who has visibility, and he created All in the Family, Maude, Good Times, The Jefferson, Sanford and Son, One Day at a Time, Mary Hartman, and his latest, The Powers That Be. Single out a couple of traits that you think he brought to television.
Well, Norman Lear is probably the easiest auteur to identify. His obsession with problems such as racism, sexism, ageism, ethnocentricity, and things like that. Suddenly, these become the conversation at the dinner table and in the living room, whereas in most sitcoms before Norman Lear, the conversation is, can I have a new mink coat, or you forgot my birthday this year, or that kind of thing. Do you know that he went with the pilot to All in the Family as early as 1969 to ABC, which had finished in last place every year since television came on the air? And they would not even air the pilot because they were too afraid of the implications of a program, especially a comedy program, that talked about racism and so forth.
Let's look at another producer, and this is Aaron Spelling, who created the Mod Squad, and along with Leonard Goldberg, he created Charlie's Angels, The Love Boat, Fantasy Island. Spelling created Dynasty, and his latest is Beverly Hills 90210. To me, all of his shows are Fantasy Island in one way or another. They're just so, they're so improbable. They're so TV.
Well, you might be interested to know that one of his first, or I should say his first successful show, which was The Mod Squad, was actually seen as an important step in social realism in television crime portrayals. It was the first show that abandoned what had been TV's sort of monolithic worship of the middle-aged white male crime fighter working alone or with a partner to protect and serve the city. Instead, he integrated the police, placed blacks and women in the department, and that was really his innovation. It was a typical of a television innovation in that it was a move toward a new invention based on conventions. By that I mean so that in Mod Squad and The Rookies and SWAT and his other police shows, we still had a white male presence as the kind of father figure who took care of planning things, even though now the action was out on the streets with blacks and women and young white men. Charlie's Angels was maybe the best example of that.
You're going to make a case for Charlie's Angels as a feminist show?
Charlie's Angels makes the case for itself as a feminist show in the beginning of each episode. We see the three angels shown as having been members of the police department, but because of institutional sexism, they were made crossing guards and office clerks. And what they really wanted to do was fight crime. And so, as the voiceover tells us, Charlie took them away from all of that and is, you know, using them so that they can become, to the best of their abilities, the great detectives and cops that they really are. So that was not a secret subtext discovered by a critic. That was the intention of the show, as stated in every episode.
Yeah, I know, but it's such this kind of TV version of feminism, you know. And they
well,
have
TV
great
version
haircuts,
of feminism
you know?
May indeed yeah. be the TV version of feminism may indeed be the version of feminism that's most salient to most Americans. Whether TV is the cause or the effect is a problem that I'm still not completely prepared to address.
David Mark is the co-author of Prime Time, Prime Movers, published by Little Brown. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry. Today we have news of the shakeup announced at General Motors today. Also, the first bit of plastic produced by a plant. It was a very tiny amount of plastic, but it shows that it can be done. The controversy in Japan over importing plutonium from Europe for breeder reactors to aid them in the pursuit of energy independence. And a talk with German filmmaker Sybil Schoenemann about her documentary in which she returned to East Germany and confronted the people who informed on her, interrogated her, tried her, and imprisoned her as a political prisoner.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Indian filmmaker Satyajit Ray died yesterday in Calcutta at the age of 70. He'd been suffering from a heart ailment and respiratory problems. Ray is critically regarded as one of the world's greatest filmmakers. He made over 30 films, from his first three movies, which comprised the Apu trilogy, to his final movie, Agantak, which he completed last year. All of his movies were low budget by Western standards, and all of them were made in his native Bengali dialect. Ray came from a family that was prominent in the arts, and although he had an early interest in film, he started his professional life in advertising. Fresh Air's film critic Stephen Schiff is a great admirer of Ray's work, so we asked him to talk with us about Ray. Many Americans were first introduced to Ray during this year's Academy Awards ceremony. He was filmed in his hospital bed in Calcutta, accepting an honorary Oscar for Lifetime Achievement in Cinema. I asked Stephen to expand on this glimpse we got of Ray.
I don't know where you saw the Academy Awards. I was at a party, and everyone was sort of hooting at the sight of a wizened old man in his bed clutching his Oscar to his bosom. And then he began to speak, and everyone went silent because the dignity and the wit and the obviously very alive intelligence that was there was stunning. And that is the kind of man he was.
Where did his films fit in within India?
You know, in India, we assume that he's a representative Indian filmmaker. He's not at all. He was very, very unusual. Really could have been said to have been the first filmmaker of his kind in India. And you have to remember two things. One, India makes more movies than any other country in the world. You know, hundreds of movies a year. And they're all pretty much the same. And you could go to India and watch them, as I have, without subtitles and still get everything that's going on in them. They're all singing, all dancing, all crazy. There's lots of sword fights. There's lots of heroics. There are supermen. There are gods and goddesses. But it's very kind of lightweight stuff. Even a four-hour epic there is a lightweight film. Ray's films were unusual in that they were humanistic. They were often thought to be too Western, although many Westerners thought they were too slow for Western tastes. They had values that were really very uncommon in Indian film, and they came from a tradition that his great sort of teacher and friend, Rabindranath Tagore, the poet and novelist who won a Nobel Prize, and who was also a Bengali, represented. And this was a break from the sort of tradition of Hinduism and even Muslim. It was about people. It was about humanism. It was about life in cities, life in villages, life, among real people. And that was the tradition that Ray came from.
Is there any subject matter that holds his body of work together?
In a way, there's not. His subject matter is enormously various. There's always a kind of Chekhovian feeling in it that I find maybe the most appealing and powerful thing about it. It's always extremely well observed. It always begins kind of on the surface of things, looking around, getting atmosphere, what's going on, and then before you know it, you're into something very deep and disturbing and rich and complex. You know, you've sunk below the surface, and you don't even know what's happening to you until everything is almost sort of out of control, headed on its way toward tragedy or towards revelation. That is at the core of his work. So you're always going from the personal to the general, but that can be said of a lot of people, and the subject matters are extremely various. You have village life in the great Apu trilogy, which began his career. You have life among the aristocracy, life among the poor, political films, historical films, contemporary films, even children's films. He covered all bases. After 1960, he wrote all of his own music, and it's very beautiful music. He also wrote music for the Merchant Ivory team. He often operated his own camera. In his later years, he even was very instrumental in the costumes and the design of the films. He was a true auteur.
Do you have a favorite film or a favorite scene that you could describe to us?
Well, I love a lot of his films. Let me just mention a few very briefly, because people think that the Apu trilogy is sort of the height of what he did, and I don't think that's true. I think he did so many amazing films. I mean, just to describe the plot of one of them called Devi, which he made in 1960, is to show you how intriguing he can be. Devi is about a very wealthy man who convinces his daughter-in-law that she is a reincarnation of the goddess Kali, and she begins to sort of have visions and act accordingly. I love his film called Distant Thunder, about this famine that occurred in 1943 that killed 5 million people, almost as many people as were killed in the Holocaust. And this is a huge story that Ray tells very, very personally and beautifully. I love his film The Home and the World, about a liberal Maharaja who decides that his wife should come out of purdah, come out of isolation and see the world. And sure enough, she falls in love with her husband's worst political enemy. But I think my favorite of his films is called Days and Nights in the Forest. And he made it in 1969. It's a sublime romantic comedy, just as wonderful and as sophisticated as, for instance, Smiles of a Summer Night by Bergman or The Philadelphia Story by Cukor. I mean, it's a magnificent film, and there's a typical shot at the beginning of it that maybe gives you a key to the way he works. This is before the credits. You're in a car with four guys from Calcutta. They're well-educated, sophisticated young guys, and they're talking about their vacation that they're about to go on in the forest. And they're grousing about things, and they're complaining, and it's sort of repartee, and it's light and it's bubbling along. And then one of them suddenly says, "Hey, look to your left." And the camera looks at the same time as the boys, and you see the forest. And suddenly the pace of the picture slows down. Music starts, the credits come on, and you're in magic land. That's the kind of effect that through very simple means Ray is capable of. And I mean, that is really like nothing else in cinema.
Well, Stephen, thank you very much for talking with us about Satyajit Ray.
Pleasure.
Stephen Schiff is Fresh Air's film critic. Several of Satyajit Ray's movies are available on video. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Joan Tuohy and Seuss Bolan. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Neil Jimenez wrote the screenplay for The River's Edge and co-wrote For the Boys. His new movie, The Water Dance, is based on the 5 months he spent in the hospital after he broke his neck in a hiking accident, leaving him paralyzed from the waist down. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.